Hi, I'm Sam Seder. This week on Ring of Fire Radio, the New Republic's David Daley will join us to lay out how Republicans love to cheat their way into power. Heather Digby Parton will help me run down another crazy week in the news as we draw closer to the election day. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us both a favor. Support the show. You can help us out and help yourself out by becoming a supporter over at ROFpodcast.com. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, as we talk, we are recording this on Thursday evening before the debate, the much anticipated final debate, or maybe the I'm not sure if the debate is is anticipated as the final aspect of it is, frankly, but the debate will happen tonight. The big story is that they will be muting Donald Trump's mics, however, only during the opening statements of each sort of lightning round. During the actual back and forth, there will be no muting of mics, so who knows? I suspect we're going to see a similar dynamic as to the last time. The only difference will be Donald Trump going off on some massive wormhole about Hunter Biden and saying that that Biden himself is corrupt, making money off of China, et cetera, et cetera. We could talk about that in a bit. We also the Amy Coney Barrett nomination is headed to the full Senate. We should discuss just how Democrats, in my estimation, have botched this by every possible measure, I think. And we also have the stimulus, which appears to be maybe possible, but Mitch McConnell certainly doesn't want one. And then, of course, there's this whole other thing in which we're talking about all of these things looming just 12 days away from us, less than 2 weeks, a week from Tuesday. It is the final day of the election, the final day that you can vote. Let's put it that way. We're already talking right now that in five states across the country, as of today, there have been more early ballots than Donald Trump got total in those states, which is, you know, I'm not 100% sure how to interpret that, whether that's just there's a lot of people early voting or if that means that there's a lot of people voting. And I don't know if we can really figure that out. But I don't know. Where do you want to start, Heather?
Well, I mean, start just by, you know, it's too bad that we are doing this before the debate because it would be interesting. Maybe we can talk about it next week. But prior to the debate, as we're sitting here talking now, yeah, Donald Trump has been showing over the days leading up to it, just a real just loss of control. I mean, he did this interview with Leslie Stahl for 60 Minutes and apparently got upset and walked out. And then he released pieces of the interview on the internet, sort of trying to, you know, usurp 60 Minutes ratings, I guess. I doubt whether that worked because the people that watch 60 Minutes obviously are, you know, older people who watch 60 Minutes and they're right, not online reading his Twitter feed. And when they see the way he behaved, which was absolutely just childish and appalling, I mean, this guy has really, you know, from all we can gather from his interviews and his Twitter feed, he is very, and his rallies that he's been holding, he has just worked himself up into a complete frenzy to the point where I wonder whether or not he's still taking that steroid that they had him on because, even for him, this is getting really beyond. So, we don't know at this point what happened in the debate. Maybe he was very calm and cool and he, you know, aced it. But, leading up to it, I wouldn't have thought that would happen. Because, you know, look, it's pretty clear what's going on here. And like you say, there's this massive early voting surge. The polling is certainly not very friendly to Trump. I wouldn't want to say that, you know, it's absolutely in the bag. But, I mean, he's having to fight for votes in places that he won pretty easily
right
last time. which is never a good place to be. And, you know, they're kind of hoping that he pulls this inside straight again, you know, and kind of if he can get Pennsylvania and, you know, so you can listen to the people going through the states over and over again trying to figure out how he can put together an electoral college when nobody expects him to win the popular vote. It's like nearly impossible that he would do that, but obviously he doesn't care. And then, of course, there's this idea, and I think that we can't take our eye off this ball, which is that if it is close in states where it could make a difference in the electoral college, states like, you know, Pennsylvania, states like Florida, Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, there are certain states where it may be close enough that these Republican lawyers that they've got deployed can then, you know, extend out the time, if nothing else, create a sort of an atmosphere of illegitimacy about the outcome, get the Supreme Court involved, which, of course, is the very reason that they wanted Amy Coney Barrett on the court before the election was. And Trump made this very clear.
We should say.
And she refused to say that she would recuse, which, of course, any person with integrity would under these circumstances. So, you know, there's still a lot of ifs going on here.
That's right. And I should just say on that last point, there was a ruling this week about Pennsylvania voting. And it was a 4-4 ruling, and so the lower court stands, and so the Democrats won that battle. I think it had to do with the extension on the ballot counting, but it made it clear that there were four votes on the court. John Roberts came over and voted with the left side of the court, to the extent that they're left, but left of certainly the center of the court. And the four who were on the right have made it clear that they have no problem interfering into the state's rights in terms of looking over their ballot. I mean, you'll recall, Digby, I know you will recall, that there were very specific, adamant words in the Bush v. Gore ruling that said this case is a one-off. It is there. It should not constitute a precedent. I think it was actually Thomas who wrote the, may have even written those words. And he himself has cited that case in arguing that the Supreme Court should get involved in what's going on with the state's elections. So they have indicated that in the event of the scenario that you describe, whether it's should we count these ballots or have these ballots been unjustly thrown out or vice versa, or whatever it is, there's going to be, once Amy Coney Barrett is seated on that court, a five-person majority who are going to feel very comfortable interfering with this election if it comes to that. And so, yes, Joe Biden needs to win by a big margin. And there's a fascinating dynamic that's going on here. I mean, I find myself, I mean, look, I do a daily show on the Majority Report, and I'm barely talking about the polls because on one hand, you know, I'm seeing stories like this from Politico. Trump is doing worse than it seems. But reporters are afraid to say so. And to some extent, I mean, I'm not afraid. I'm certainly hesitant to, like, but on the other hand, you see things like in Pennsylvania, in, I think it's Wisconsin and Michigan as well, maybe also in Florida and a little bit in Arizona. Republicans are beating Democrats in new voter registrations, not by huge margins, but by statistically significant, if you define that as what was the margin that Donald Trump won these states won last time, right? I mean, if the Republicans are registering an extra 60,000 people in Pennsylvania, well, Donald Trump won that by 40,000 last time. Now, then you get into attrition and this and that. So the bottom line is the polls look very good for Joe Biden. They look better for Joe Biden at this point than they did for Hillary Clinton. And they're really, to the extent that they've attempted to deploy their Comey letter of 2016, there doesn't seem to be one. And so, you know, based upon that, it looks good. But because of these voter registrations, we don't really know if the pollsters are polling the right people, if their models are the same. So I think the bottom line is people need to go out and vote if they're interested in Donald Trump not being president, regardless of what the situation is. And so, you know, with that being said, like, that's why I don't really talk about that much, frankly, because it's like, I don't know. You know, I have no idea. I just know that people should vote. And it is an interesting sort of dynamic. They have deployed this Hunter Biden stuff, and it seems really, I mean, on some level, nonsensical. But I almost like get the sense of, well, I'm not sure why people would care about what Hunter Biden was doing, you know, and what email he was sending to Joe Biden when Joe Biden was a private citizen. That's the big email dump. It was from May of 2017, 6 months after Joe Biden was out of office. I'm not sure why people should care.
But you know why.
Well, but
yeah, you know,
no,
why. Because it's just to titillate the right wing. That's all.
Yes. No, but I'm saying I don't know why they think it should, because, you know, there's not the narrative that existed with Hillary Clinton that this feeds into. Like, they are whole cloth. I mean, let's not forget, 6 weeks ago it was Sleepy Joe, right? And 3 weeks ago it was Joe's actually just going to do the bidding of Bernie Sanders. So the point is that, like, this is not stuff that you can bring up in the last, you know, 15 minutes of a campaign and say, hey, you know, the 6 or 7 months that we've had to define Joe Biden as, you know, mortally corrupt. Well, we didn't do it then. We're doing it now. And, you know, with Hillary Clinton, the right wing had been building this narrative for years and years and years and years. You know, it's not like on one hand, they're like, Joe Biden's been in office for 47 years. He's never done anything. And then with 5 minutes left in the election, they're like, oh, incidentally, he's horribly corrupt. Well, why didn't that come up before? Like, there's just no way for it to. What it is we're seeing a lot of desperation, I think.
Absolutely. I do think, though, and I wrote about this week for Salon, that, you know, that you kind of, if you kind of step back and look at what this, at the Hunter Biden conspiracy theory that they have going, and which obviously Trump and a whole bunch of Republicans have been pushing for a long time. I mean, this goes back to the Ukraine thing. I mean, Trump was impeached over this, right?
Right.
I mean, the whole point of the impeachment was that he was trying to, you know, extort the Ukrainian president to, you know, go in and you know, pimp this particular story for him. And he didn't even have to, you know, do anything. They just wanted the announcement, right, so that they could use this. So they wanted to get this thing going. They just never really could grasp onto it. And I don't really think it's so much a Trump thing. I mean, it is at the moment because he is desperate, and I think the Trump campaign is desperate. And I don't think it's doing meaningful in any way in the election upcoming. I mean, it's just too arcane and weird and, you know, whatever. And I don't think that Joe Biden scans in this election as being this corrupt guy for the reasons that you point out. But this is a useful thing that is going to be with us if Joe Biden wins. And I think that's really the play here. You know, you've got all this conspiracy theory stuff going, you know, QAnon and all that, and I don't know where that's going to go. The fever may break on some of the super crazy stuff that's out there a little bit once Trump is out of office, because his chaos, you know, the chaos thing with him is, you know, that it that just feeds itself, right? It's like a feedback loop, QAnon, Trump, you know, all this craziness. But the Hunter Biden thing is a classic Republican conspiracy scandal, you know, hook for their people. And I can very easily see this dog, you know, it's Benghazi, it's Whitewater, it's these things. And the piece that I wrote sort of went back and looked at the way these scandals unfold. And they all are just sort of, this is what they want to do is drip, drip, drip stuff out that doesn't ever add up to anything. And by the way, just to get this out of the way, this Hunter Biden scandal is total BS. It is not real because the central aspect of this scandal is they accuse Hunter Biden of getting a favor from his father for the company that he was working for to stop a prosecution in Ukraine against the company that he was working for. And the truth is that Joe Biden did the opposite. He actually got rid of the prosecutor for not doing that prosecution.
And it wasn't...
that it was, you know, it was the opposite of what they're saying that it was. There is, it is completely false in every way. But, you know...
And we should also say, that was not only stated U.S. policy, like stated U.S. public policy, it was under pressure from the European Union that wanted the U.S. to do that. I mean, all of this was very public. I mean, none of this, that's why Joe Biden was very sort of like comfortable saying, I went in there and leveraged the money that we were, the aid that we were getting, unless you fire that guy, because it was U.S. stated policy. And he was just, you know, sort of bragging about how he executed it. That's the thing that I don't quite understand. That it's almost like, you know, they really need to flesh this out because...
Well, I think they plan to. I think that's really what this is about. And I don't think, you know, I have no idea what Hunter Biden did in Ukraine or China. From what we understand, they did make some money. I mean, Joe Biden was out of government at the time, et cetera, et cetera. But you can just see how this could churn up into an endless kind of a storyline, a narrative that they are building about Joe Biden and his, you know, drug-addicted son and how they made a bunch of money selling influence and all this stuff. I mean, this is like the Clinton Foundation or Uranium One or, you know, all of this stuff. This is what they do. This is their patented style. Now, you know, whether or not it has any legs, we don't know that.
Right. But true.
And of course, the good part is that if Joe Biden wins election, there's good reason to hope at this point that he will also have a majority in the Congress, which means there won't be the investigations. But you still, you know, Fox News still has to make money.
Right.
And you've got all this, you know, this right-wing media, you've got all the Facebook groups, you've got all this stuff that is sort of dependent on feeding this beast that they've created. And so I see this as being, you know, something we are going to be dealing with for a long time to come. And because Hunter Biden had a drug problem, you know, there's all this titillating stuff, which creepy jerks like Rudy Giuliani love to sort of dribble out and, ew, look at this, you know, and that part of it.
I gotta say, based upon what we know about Rudy Giuliani in the Sacha Baron Cohen movie, I don't think you want to say Rudy Giuliani is dribbling anything.
Yeah. Sorry about that. I apologize to the audience.
It's not the adjective I think that I would use.
But imagine how that came to mind without me thinking. It just sort of, you know, that just seemed like the obvious term. But, you know, you have that kind of creepy side. Now, on the other hand, I heard, and I can't remember, one of the New York Times reporters, I think it was, maybe it was Jonathan Martin, mentioned on Twitter the other day that in the interviews he's been doing with people around the country, that one of the things that came up that really offended quite a few people, and they specifically brought it up to him, he said, was the way Trump was crudely insulting about Hunter Biden's addiction.
Yep.
And that in America, you know, I mean, this is something that people are dealing with, you know, on a daily basis in their own families. And the idea that, of course, you love your kid or your father or whoever it is that's having this problem, the idea that Trump would make fun of that. And you've got Don Jr. out there just hammering it like crazy, the drug part. That may not be a really, you know, smart way for them to go. They might want to rethink that. So, you know, so anyway, I don't mean to belabor this because I don't know how big a deal it is. But it occurred to me that it will be with us for a while and that the Republicans are going to go back to their patented ways. They've never changed. You know, I mean, it's not like they're suddenly going to discover their, you know, that these things are not useful to them and they're going to be straight and let's just talk policy or something, because they won't.
I totally agree with that. I think, though, my sense is that this is not going to work. Because, I mean, it's not even just a matter of it not working. I don't think it's just going to be fruitful for the right, just in terms of on their, you know, even on the most narrow of terms, because there isn't there isn't a long-term value to it for them. Like, I think most people right now, and maybe it won't be the case, but I mean, if I had to guess, I think Joe Biden is, you know, he's pitched himself as a bit of a caretaker president. If he becomes president, I don't know that he would serve more than one term. I would be very, very surprised if the Republicans don't pivot relatively quickly after the election to demonizing Kamala Harris, right? Because that's the next battle, and I don't know. It's almost right. If I was to say, like, okay, what should I read into right now? If I'm anticipating a Biden administration, I'm going to read into, you know, climate change policy and maybe voting rights and also how reconciliation works. Because those are going to be that's what's going to be in the future. We're going to get a reconciliation bill that's going to happen in the first month of a Biden presidency that is going to offer a certain amount of stimulus and probably hopefully, automatic stabilizers. And then the next thing on the docket, I would imagine, is going to be climate change legislation. And so if I want to, you know, get on television or whatever it is, I'm going to read into that. And I just think that, like, from the right wing is entrepreneurial, if it's not anything else in this space. In fact, I would say it dictates almost their politics.
Sure.
You know, on an individual level, like, what's going to make me a bunch of cash? And so I think they got to be starting to look like, how can they work, you know, how can they tie in Kamala Harris into Burisma or something?
And you're right. They came up with some email that was sent to Hunter Biden's business partner that mentioned that Kamala Harris was a contact that was, you know, could be useful to them. So, of course, they'll tie it all in. And she, of course, has, you know, many attributes that are much more fun for the right wing to attack.
She's a woman of color, of course. I mean, she's a much better target.
She's young, and she's probably going to be running in 2024, as the incumbent. It's hard to imagine that Joe Biden's going to run again. I mean, maybe he will, but it seems much more likely that she'll be the nominee in 2024, or at least will run as the nominee. Of course, and they'll work very hard to, you know, demonize her, and they're very good at this, Sam. I mean, they really are. I mean, this is something that, I mean, they don't do governance well at all. We've seen that. That's true from, you know, every Republican administration we've seen in the last 30 years, or ever since Nixon, really. They don't do governance very well. They really don't. But they do this form of politics very well. And it really fits in with our modern entertainment, infotainment kind of political world, which you and I are part of. So, you know, we can't complain too much about that. But it is true that they're good at that. And I think that everybody has to gird themselves and recognize that. I don't think they're going to be chastised. I think this idea that, well, they're going to get together and they'll put together a new Republican Party and they'll be more responsible.
You don't think the fever is going to break, Heather?
Yeah. I'm thinking maybe that, you know, they're not going to have that epiphany, or, you know, whatever that epiphany is. Even if, well, look at it this way. Let's assume they do, and they say, you know what, but that Trump thing was just terrible. We don't know what happened there. We're going to go back to normal. Remember what normal was like?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't exactly great, and on a number of levels. I mean, from, you know, imperialism and, you know, authoritarianism and all of that stuff. I mean, Trump didn't invent that, and so, you know, I think our work will be cut out for us in this particular style, this kind of Nixonian dirty tricks, scandal mongering, just, you know, hardcore, you know, no holds barred style of character assassination and just, you know, the worst sort of, you know, dirty politics. This is who they've been for a very, very long time, and I don't see that changing. So I would hope that everybody, you know, recognizes that this is, you know, that the Trump era may come to an end, but the Republican, you know, the hard right Republican authoritarian dirty tricks era, which has been with us for a long time, you know, is not necessarily coming to an end, you know, and I hope everybody realizes that, particularly the Biden administration, if there is one.
Well, I mean, all you need to do is look at what's going on in the Senate, you know, as we speak. You know,
exactly.
I mean, this was Mitch McConnell was doing this stuff with Merrick Garland in the Supreme Court before anybody even imagined that Donald Trump was going to be the president.
And what they're doing with the stimulus right now. You know, they're laying landmines for the Democrats.
Let's be really clear on what's going on here with the stimulus. There are, and it was actually, I mean, you and I have talked about this over the past couple of weeks, and there was a piece in the Washington Post by Waldman and Sargent writing together, basically laying this out. And you and I have talked about this as well, I think, in a very similar fashion. There are two or three scenarios that are possible following the election. One is that Donald Trump is still president and Mitch McConnell is the leader of the Senate. The other is that Joe Biden is the president and Mitch McConnell is the leader of the Senate. Or Joe Biden is president and Chuck Schumer is the leader of the Senate. In the last in the last scenario, we can expect the next stimulus bill to come probably the first week in February. And I don't think it's going to involve having to get rid of the filibuster. I think they're going to be able to do it in reconciliation, I've been reading now, so that they're thinking about doing it in that regard. But that means...
Why not just get rid of the filibuster?
I think they will get rid of the filibuster. And this, in my mind, that would be a good way to do it. But I think they want to avoid that. I think they want to avoid doing that up front. Why do they want to avoid that? Because they want to avoid all conflict. I mean, why did, you know, what we saw, well, I'll circle back around this, but I think that's what, I think, frankly, I think that's a great way to kill the filibuster is to say the American public needs stimulus.
Yeah.
They need help. And you guys are in the way of it. We're going to get rid of the filibuster and do the bidding of the American public. Now, that means that we are now close to 5 months out from getting stimulus. That is desperately needed. We have 1 million people whose unemployment insurance has now ended. And it's going to get worse over the next couple of months. And we're going to see states and cities hit hard. The other scenario is that Donald Trump wins and Mitch McConnell wins. And I think we'll get a stimulus in that instance in a matter of weeks. Because Mitch McConnell is... But if Joe Biden is the president and Mitch McConnell is the Senate leader... We're not going to get any stimulus. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It's going to come. I mean, end of story. Like, there's not going to be expansion of unemployment. There's not going to be one-off stimulus checks. Maybe they will do some, like, you know, expansion of corporate tax breaks or something like that. But we will not get a stimulus. And that gives you a sense of exactly who the Republican Party is. Like, the American people are hurting, and Mitch McConnell... He will not pass a single bill out of that Senate. He will not. He will not. He will not. We won't get a single hearing for a single judge or justice. I mean, he will start from day one. He has perfected this with Barack Obama. He learned how to do it. He spent years doing it, and he has perfected it. On day one, he will completely shut down the functioning of the Senate as a mechanism to provide anything for the American public, and so. He is out there today, and by today, I mean today and yesterday and tomorrow, saying to Donald Trump, don't trust Nancy Pelosi. She just wants you to do this big stimulus bill. It's not going to help you at all. And he has convinced Donald Trump of this, I think, for the most part, because Donald Trump's an idiot. And if Donald Trump, you know, has been threatening, like, I'll double what Nancy Pelosi is offering, you know, I'll do $4 trillion, isn't it? If Donald Trump had literally half a brain, that's what he would do. He would tell Steve Mnuchin, like, yeah, when she says I want this, you say, sorry, no, we want double. And boom, because Nancy Pelosi is also a little afraid of that to some extent as well.
Like, sure is.
And then, but I say, you know, I think Pelosi's playing this wrong because I don't think it's going to benefit Donald Trump that much, as she seems to think it will. And what it will do is it will stop. It will make it much harder to vote on Amy Coney Barrett before the election, because Mitch McConnell is not going to be able to deal with this cleanly in the Senate. And to have Donald Trump attack Mitch McConnell, I just don't think it's going to necessarily benefit Donald Trump. I mean, there's just not enough. There's not enough time for this to permeate people's minds. I say Nancy Pelosi should take even the $1.8 trillion bill, that so that something gets out there to people, and make Mitch McConnell make his senators either vote for it or against it. And I think this is a huge missed opportunity by Nancy Pelosi, and I think it has frankly to do with her trying to placate her her constituents so that she maintains power in the House, frankly. Otherwise, it doesn't make much sense, not only from a moral standpoint, but also from a political standpoint. Like, I'm sorry, I just don't think that Donald Trump is going to benefit from, sending out another $12,000 or $1,200 check that's not going to reach people by the time of the election anyways. I mean, he already wrote a $1,200 check to everybody, and people still think he's garbage. But make Mitch McConnell force, half a dozen of his senators who are up for re-election, make Mitch McConnell make them vote against it. You know what I mean? Like, this is, I think it's incredibly unfortunate that that Pelosi is operating in this manner. I mean, I understand, like, you can hear her when she talks and she goes on interviews and she says, I think she said this to Jake Tapper, I'm listening to my constituents, I'm listening to my committee chairs. And that is the key there. When she says, I'm listening to my committee chairs, what she's saying is, I'm listening to the people, because the bill, you gotta look at the bill as a bunch of silos, and those silos are represented, are the interests of the committee chairs. And she doesn't want to cut any of those silos, because those committee chairs have their own constituents, and their constituents are the members of their committee who have their own little silos that have been rolled up into the one silo that they hand to Pelosi. And Pelosi wants to make sure that all those constituents, and by these constituents, I mean not the people in San Francisco, but the constituents in her caucus.
Right, right.
She wants to make sure that she has not offended them, because she wants to serve as Speaker of the House again. And so she won't accept the $1.8 trillion bill, even though it's $400,000 less. I mean, $400 billion less than what she had offered, because that means cutting some of those silos. And she doesn't want to weaken herself. I just don't buy 12 days out that the American public is going to be like, Pelosi and Mnuchin negotiated something, I'm voting for Donald Trump. I just don't see how that happens. And even if Trump goes out there and says, I did it, I passed something, I just don't think that's going to get the coverage that is going to be meaningful in any way. What will make a difference is that when Mitch McConnell, with 12 days left, has to try and rush through this bill so that he can vote on Amy Coney Barrett, and he's got senators who are going to want to vote against it. And either Mitch McConnell is going to end up passing this with a majority of Democrats. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, this is the situation that if you want Republicans to be buried, that's the situation you want. And Nancy Pelosi wants Republicans to be buried, but not more than she wants to be Speaker of the House. And I think that's a real problem.
Do you think McConnell would rush it through? Do you think he would do that before the election? That's the part I just don't understand the process there. He's put this $500 billion thing on, and the Democrats all voted against it just this week. And will McConnell put this, if they come to an agreement, will he put it on the floor, or will they come to an agreement without? This is the thing I guess I don't get about the process. Do you think Mnuchin would agree to a deal, and Pelosi and Mnuchin would come to an agreement, and without knowing whether or not McConnell would put it on the floor?
I think if Mnuchin comes to a deal, And Nancy Pelosi's in a position of like, we've made a deal with Donald Trump, and Mitch McConnell is basically giving the finger to Donald Trump. I mean, that is a good situation to be in, too.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the part I think, to me, that seems like the logical outcome here. I think McConnell has cut Trump loose. I think he knows.
Oh, without Trump, a doubt. You know, and I don't think that Donald Trump realizes it.
No, he doesn't. Donald Trump is living in a dream world. I mean, he's out there saying that he's getting 30,000 people in airport hangars. You know, I mean, he's.
And this is why, if I'm Nancy Pelosi, I, to be able to say to Donald Trump, hey, dude, Mitch McConnell, he's cut you loose. I mean, what more do you want? Donald Trump will go after Mitch McConnell. Only
that's
to
true.
The benefit
you know, that
of...
That is true. That I mean, could make the difference in the Senate races, right? I mean,
oh
Trump goes
gosh.
After McConnell.
Yes.
And suddenly it's chaos. It's absolute,
absolute
like
chaos.
A pitched battle in the Republican
because,
Party. And some of these races in places like Georgia that are close, these Senate races, or Texas.
Minneapolis or Minnesota.
Yeah.
I mean, Tina
yeah,
Smith
right,
has got,
yeah.
got a real race there. I mean, can you imagine, or in Michigan... Can you imagine if Tina Smith or Rogers could look at their opponent and say, where do you stand? Do you stand with the president or do you stand with Mitch McConnell? I mean,
yeah.
You're damned if you do, if you're damned if you don't. That is like the that is the dream question
right.
for all of these candidates to ask of a Republican. Like,
absolutely.
You know, like there's a huge cleave here. Who do you stand with? Why are you preventing Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump from providing relief to the American public? And I mean that's you know because then Donald Trump will be going around and every time when he stops in one of these states he's going to be attacking the senator in that state, the Republican senator who's preventing him from getting the aid. I mean that to me seems you know fairly obvious. And while we're on it, Thursday. Today, we saw the senators lined up on the steps of the Senate from the Judiciary Committee saying they're boycotting the vote. Now, you and I, we talked about this 3 or 4 weeks ago. I was saying that's what they should have done on day one of the hearings, not gone in there. To do it today, after Dianne Feinstein went in there praising Lindsey Graham, maybe costing the Democrats, the South Carolina Senate seat, certainly increasing Amy Coney Barrett's favorability ratings, the percentage of people amongst Democrats and independents, too, who say that she should be confirmed has gone up through this process.
I know.
That is an abject failure on part of the Democrats, an abject failure. And it's on Dianne Feinstein and it's on Chuck Schumer, who, again, thinks that he is performing constituent services for the people he's supposed to lead, as opposed to telling them we need to do this for the sake of the Democratic Party or the sake of other senators running in races or for the sake of Joe Biden. We have two members of the leadership, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, who put their ability to stay in that position above leading for the benefit of, in my mind, the American public, but even narrowly tailored for the Democrats. And, you know, they're catering to the constituent wishes of, you know, their individual senators or the people who are keeping them in the leadership. And that is, they're not expending anything and they're missing these major opportunities. I'm flabbergasted by it, frankly.
Well, and I agree with you on this. And it's funny because at the time, and you and I talked about this, and I think I was a little bit more, I think you were always for the full boycott, and I was sort of on the fence seeing, you know, both sides of it, thinking, well, you know, they don't want to mess up the election by, you know, somehow, you know, or doing, you know, very aggressive questioning of Coney Barrett or not, or boycotting the hearing or whatever, so maybe just doing this kind of gentle thing that they did, which was pretty gentle. I mean, they elicited some interesting stuff from her, but so what? You know, she's still going to win. So what was the point? But looking back on it now, I absolutely agree that you were right, that the boycott would have been the better thing to do. For one thing, I don't think it would have made any difference at all in the Senate races had they done that. The Democrats would have just said it was just a clean statement. The statement would have been, look, this is an illegitimate process. We are 2 weeks away from the election. This is outrageous. They're basically taking the seat, and we just don't think this is right. The people should be able to weigh in on this seat. And moreover, the only reason they're trying to do it before the election is to try and give Donald Trump an extra vote on the Supreme Court in case the election goes to the Supreme Court, and that is even more illegitimate. So they certainly had a very clean argument for boycotting it, and instead what they did, they turned it into a normal Supreme Court confirmation. We've seen them a million times.
Yep.
There was Clarence Thomas. There was, the Kavanaugh thing. We've watched them all. It's just another one of those. It's not. It's so not one of those. This is completely outrageously illegitimate. And by normalizing it that way, and then Dianne Feinstein, my God, I mean, I don't know how many people actually saw that. But we did, and a lot of people did, and it just, it was just like,
well,
got to be kidding me.
We know a lot of South Carolina voters saw it because they clipped it immediately and ran it as an ad for Lindsey Graham.
Of course. It's just like, are you kidding? I mean, poor Jamie Harrison must have gone, gee, thanks. Thanks a lot. I mean, it was outrageous. And the whole, everything about that was just, why? And everybody asking these questions. Yes, well, tell us, would you be able to tell us the five freedoms? No, I can't tell you. Well, nobody cares. And we're in the middle of this wild election with all this stuff going on. And they ended up just normalizing the thing. Okay.
Yep.
It's just another Supreme Court confirmation. So I think you're absolutely right. Now, here's the one. This will really kill you. They stand on the steps because the Judiciary Committee, voted her out on Thursday. And they go and stand on the steps. We're boycotting this. Well, they're only boycotting the Judiciary Committee. They're going to go and vote on the floor. And so once again, and the first thing that came, I was listening to the radios in my car when I heard this, and I'm going, they just cannot pass up the opportunity to make those speeches. They've got to make those speeches, so they're going to be on the floor ranting and raving. Nobody will hear it. It'll all sound like so much noise, and nothing will change. And there'll just be another confirmation hearing with a bunch of Senate bloviators. And, one of the things, and I've written about this for years, and I know you've been talking about it too, that Republicans have a way of, they know how to lose well, and
yes.
By which I don't mean lose,
graciously.
Graciously.
Right.
I mean, they know how to lose in a way that benefits them in the longer term. They figure out, they think in strategically that way, that, okay, this is a lost cause. I'm not going to win this. Why not? Well, it's like Mitch McConnell, what we were just talking about, that, he's seeing that Donald Trump is going to lose. So he's setting himself up so that he can be in the position, assuming that, he gets what he wants here, and he's pretty savvy about figuring out how this is going to go, that, he is going to cripple the Biden administration.
Presidency, yep.
From the beginning, he's already setting that up, and hopefully he's hoping that he pulls out enough Senate seats to be able to keep his majority. But even from the minority, he will be in a position to have strangled the new Biden administration by failing to get any of this, this stimulus relief out there, and Biden will come in to an economy that is absolutely in devastating depression level. Horror for the American people. And so, he's thinking that way. And the Democrats just don't do that.
From
the beginning, they were going to lose this Supreme Court thing. They just were. They didn't have the power to stop it. So what can you make out of that? How can you turn that into something that you can use for, by the way, maybe expanding the court, maybe make a big statement that this was unusual?
They, first of all, that they do not know, it seems, to expend a political price, right? Like, if they're going to lose, how do you make it as costly as possible for the Republicans in this battle? Now, I am of the mind that there is enough of the Democrats who are afraid of the expansion of the Supreme Court that they didn't want to amplify the outrage because that would put more pressure on them to expand the Supreme Court. That's, I mean, you know, maybe that's a cynical perspective on it, but I have no doubt that incompetence is generally the main problem. But in other instances, this incompetence is also like a, you know, the only way I can put this is in the context of sports, and forgive me, and not watching sports, but playing sports. And maybe you can also, you know, in anything that is performative in some way, when you start to get overly cautious, you make mistakes. You need to be able to be fully committed to what you're doing,
right,
to do it well. And I think the Democrats are, it's not just, it's not an overly cautious thing. It's an ideological cautiousness. There is a certain ideology that is there. And, you know, and I spoke to Brian Fallon this week from Demand Justice, and, you know, just the concept of like, of how adamant, you know, Patrick Leahy was to be okay with blue slips. And,
exactly.
And Dianne Feinstein saw this, and blue slips is the,
yep,
way that basically the vast majority of judges were prevented from being nominated,
yep,
in the Obama administration. Dianne Feinstein saw this, and she still wants to offer, she wants to get into power and then allow the Republicans to use blue slips again.
Oh my God. And, really? I hadn't,
yes,
heard.
Oh yeah.
That. Oh.
And I mean, this is insanity. This is insanity. It is like the Republicans have the car. They have repeatedly run you over with the car. Then you get the car back and you say, oh, here, Republicans, here are the keys.
Here are the keys, yeah, please. And let me, I'm just going to stand right here, right in front of you, just in case, you know, just to wave at you. So here you go. You'll see how much I trust you if I do that. Well, that's outrageous. I hadn't heard that, and that is unbelievable. But, you know, from her, it's, I guess it is believable. And this is, and it is, there is an ideological, you know, sort of, you know, this is, well, two wrongs don't make a right, you know, that kind of thing. Well, I think they're going to have a problem with that, because I think the Democratic Party is filled with a bunch of newer people, and I don't mean this in terms of just, you know, sheerly on, you know, left and centrist ideology.
Yep, I
mean, I
agree totally.
I think there's a difference in ideology, in this kind of ideology that we're talking about, the ideology of fighting.
In partisanship.
There are people coming up, even some centrists who are, you know, from districts that, you know, they may be all about guns and God knows what else. But on this thing, on this kind of, you know, wait a minute, you know, we're not going to do that. I think that that old guard is going to have a problem. And, of course, we know who, you know, some members of the old guard, one of them's going to be probably the president. So that's kind of a problem. And then you've got a whole bunch of them in power, people who, for whatever reason, and it's not just the age problem. It's, you know, I mean, we've talked about,
the mentality.
You know, Chris Coons. There's,
yep,
a, you know, it's a mentality. It is, as you say, an ideology. But there are going to be, I think there's a much bigger faction, probably, hopefully, I think a majority of Democrats who are, you know, they came up in a time when, you know, you were seeing the Republicans behave in the way they've been behaving, and they have learned,
yep,
that this is not going to work. I mean, we, people like us, have been saying this for the last 15 years.
Yep.
We've been going, hey, you know, wake the hell up, people. Look at what's going on. And I think that these people, the cautious faction is going to have a fight on its hands. I don't think it's going to be easy for them to get away with doing that. I think there's going to be, and certainly there's going to be external pressure,
Heather,
from people.
From, yep, your mouth to whoever's ears are important to hear. Well, let's leave on that. Let's keep that as an optimistic note. Next week, we will be back for our final conversation before at least the last day that people can vote, you know, election day. We don't know if it's going to be resolved on that day. We could be coming back 2 weeks from now and going like, it's all up to Pennsylvania,
God,
and Florida. That would, you and I will, I don't know. I will probably be, if that's the case, I will probably be drunk at that point. I will have been drinking for
I'll
at least two or three days. and it won't be just alcohol. It'll be anything I can get my hands on, you know, nail
exactly,
polish remover, whatever it is. Heather, Always a pleasure. We will talk to you next week.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Next guest has written an amazing piece in the New Republic forecasting what could be an election night scenario, where Donald Trump declares victory before millions of ballots are counted in swing states across the country. Here to explain how the Republicans have cheated their way to a permanent minority rule, David Daley. So, David, you have written quite a bit in the past, obviously, about elements of the Republican strategy to win with less. And by less, I mean less votes and still win. And it really is, you know, maybe we'll talk at the end of this of just how much lack of democracy our democracy can take, right? I mean, there's a little bit of room for this, obviously, that exists, but at one point things start to crack and crumble. But we'll get to that in a bit. You, in your cover story for The New Republic, you use James Sensenbrenner as an intro into, I guess, what used to be, before we get to the three elections you write have fundamentally altered the way we elect people, I guess, in this country.
I think that's right. And Sensenbrenner is a really interesting figure. He is a Republican from the suburbs of Milwaukee. He has been in Congress since at least 1980. He's involved in the first reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act in 1982. When it comes around again, he is chairman of Judiciary in 2005. And he looks over his shoulder and he sees Lamar Smith from Texas is next in line as he's about to be term limited out as chair. And he says, I've got to get something done on this now because the party is changing. And if I don't, it might not happen. So he actually calls up John Conyers. He calls up Mel Watt.
And I'm sorry, David, let me just interrupt. Yeah. For people who don't know who James Sensenbrenner was, he was a longtime Republican congressman from Wisconsin.
Exactly, the longtime Republican congressman. And in 2006, when the Republicans hold a trifecta in Washington, Sensenbrenner decides he will make a deal with the Democrats to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act for 25 years. And it passes Congress nearly unanimously. They go out and they generate a 12,000-page record on why Section 5, the key preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act that required localities in states that had a history of racial prejudice in voting to clear any change in voting with the federal government. They generated a massive document of why this was needed, and they convinced members of both sides. It passes the Senate 98-0, and it clears the House something like 390-25. It feels like a fever dream from another time.
And let's just be clear, you know, Sensenbrenner, Sensenbrenner was around for enough to see multiple presidents deal with the Voting Rights Act, and. You know, just, you know, to fill out for people who don't know, Section 5 is basically you have a couple of different provisions to the Voting Rights Act that make it what it is. Section 2 is sort of an opt-in to the preclearance. And Section 5 was an existing preclearance requirement. And we should tell people that it was, I think it's about 14 or 16 states. Maybe it was 16 counties and 14 states.
16 states, yes.
And this included New York City, parts of, I think it was Queens, and maybe the Bronx, where there had been a history of minority voters being disenfranchised for whatever reason. Just to make it clear, to understand that, you know, like there had to be a legitimate history of this type of disenfranchisement to be a part of that preclearance. It was not, you know, some relic of, you know, punishing folks from the South.
Exactly right.
I just wanted to make that clear for people who didn't know. And Sensenbrenner, you write, also was there when Reagan was even questioning this, yes?
Certainly. Reagan was under a lot of pressure in 1982. There were folks in his Justice Department. There was a young analyst in the Justice Department. His name was John Roberts. He very much wanted to do away with Section 2 and Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act as far back as 1980. But Sensenbrenner gets Reagan's ear, and he says, we still need this. And in 1982, he was able to convince Reagan and other Republicans that even though it wasn't 1965 any longer, this was still a crucial piece of the voting rights legislation and much needed.
You know, it's funny, like I'm reading this and, I was an adult in 92, 93. But the concept of the Republicans being on board with this type of thing seems so foreign to me now. And I'm fascinated by the story of Sensenbrenner that he saw this coming as, you know, as early. Well, I mean, I guess maybe 15 years ago or so, 2007 was not, or 2005 was not. I mean, I guess I admit that I also saw that coming at that time.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's interesting. I think, you know, that was still ahead of the curve for that type of person, right? I mean, I was a talk radio show host, so I was very attuned to what was going on right-wing talk radio. I wrote a book about, not a great book, but about saying that this was not your father's Republican Party anymore. Sensenbrenner really got that, really understood that, and was trying to sort of like, I don't know, it was almost like he was trying to put the Voting Rights Act in a bottle and send it out to sea so that it would be safe during this time.
I think that's what he was trying to do. 25 years, it would, you know, this is the longest reauthorization yet. And the deal he makes with Watt and Conyers is kind of fascinating because it's 2006, you know, and Democrats were looking good to take the House back. And he went to them and said, listen, even if you take the House back, you will have to deal with this guy as the ranking member of the committee. You don't even want that. Let's get this taken care of now.
And what motivated Sensenbrenner? I mean, just obviously a sense of justice, but I mean, it's, you know, like I say, it's so hard to imagine a Republican doing something that did not have a direct benefit to them from a power perspective. And I mean, you know, and in terms of the party, I mean, that's why it's just so hard to wrap my head around it these days.
It's almost hallucinatory because the party has moved so diametrically in the opposite direction. It now depends on voter suppression as a strategy for keeping control with fewer votes. Sensenbrenner told me that he still remembered some of his early state Senate campaigns and early House campaigns in Wisconsin in the 1970s and the 80s, in which he would go around Milwaukee and hear stories from blacks in Wisconsin telling him about how hard it had been for them to register and vote. So I think it was still fresh with him, and it still angered him.
So Sensenbrenner gets the authorization. Like you say, it passes overwhelmingly in both houses. And then things start to go. I mean, he really, I mean, you know, I give him what he tried, and he really had some foresight. I mean, this was everything he thought that was going to happen. I suspect, I don't know if he knew the specifics, but the general gist of it comes about. And you've written extensively.
They built that 12,000 page record because he knew what was coming at the Supreme Court.
And okay, so he's got this 12,000 page record. 2010, you say in your piece, it's basically, this is a story of three elections where we go from a guy like Jim Sensenbrenner, who is developing a 12,000 page record to support the premise of voting rights in this country, and specifically the idea that, you know, you can't let these states that have had a history of disenfranchising people of color or other minorities, just broadly speaking, and And then 2010 hits, and you've written a book about really about this project. That, but tell us about it. Give us the short form of what happens in 2010 in the lead up to 2010. This is when Barack Obama is basically telling people in the Democratic caucus, "I got this."
He didn't have this. Let me tell you, Obama wins a huge election in 2008, right? Democratic supermajority in the U.S. Senate follows. And Republicans take a look and they say, well, we just got wiped out. The demographics of the nation are changing. What can we do? And they take a look at 2010 and they realize, well, that election can be much more consequential than even 2008 was, because it's a redistricting year. It's a census year. And after the census, we redraw all of the state legislative districts and congressional districts around the country. The party that is in control of state legislatures in just about four-fifths of the state controls that process entirely. And they said, well, how about if we set out to take control of swing state legislatures in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, Ohio, North Carolina, Florida, Wisconsin, all of these states sound familiar, right? That they are still the swing states that we are talking about. They are still states in which we are seeing voter suppression efforts to this very day. All of this really begins in 2010 when Republicans run this plan called Red Map. It's short for the Redistricting Majority Project. They spend $30 million throwing dark money, throwing negative ads against incumbent Democratic state legislatures and swing state legislatures that never saw it coming. They knocked them out in 2011. They redraw these maps. They locked themselves into power. They have not lost a single chamber in any of those states yet. There's 50 million of us living in these states, almost one in six Americans. And in 2018, 50 million of us living in a state in which one or both chambers of the state legislature under control of the party that won fewer votes. Always the case that it's Democrats that got more votes, Republicans that have all the power. From there.
Well, no, hold on. Let me stop you there for one second. Let me stop you, because I need people really need to hear that part. And I would encourage people to read your book, Rat Effed, which you wrote, I guess, about 4 years ago now, that covers this process. But that last statistic, there are how many states do we have in this country where more people voted for Democratic representatives? In other words, if you tally up all the votes cast in that state for state reps and state senators, the Democrats would have gotten over 50% of those votes. And yet, when you look at the makeup of those houses, Democrats have less than 50%.
Yeah. The number of states, I don't know, but the number of Americans living in those states, it's more than 50 million of us. It was 59 million until a fair map in Virginia was instituted in 2019 and Democrats finally took control. In North Carolina, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, Democrats routinely win hundreds of thousands more votes, and Republicans oftentimes hold supermajorities of seats thanks to the maps that they drew themselves. They have entrenched an enduring minority rule in many of these swing states that Democrats have not been able to dent over the course of an entire decade. I mean, these maps have now have been in place for almost 10 years.
Wow.
And Democrats have yet to win a single chamber back in any of those states.
And I just Wisconsin, coincidentally, where Sensenbrenner was from, sticks in my mind because I think the statistic is Democrats won 54% of the vote in 2018. But end up with 44%, 45%, 45%, maybe even less, actually.
It's
36% of the representation. I mean, that's just bonkers. It is bonkers, and
it's bonkers on top of bonkers because, I mean, voters in 2018 in Wisconsin reelect Tammy Baldwin. They kick Scott Walker out of office. They give Democrats every single statewide office. They give them 200,000 more votes for the state assembly, and Democrats budge one seat as a result of that, and they push the majority down to just 63-36.
And people should understand, and you outline this quite well in RADEFT, that the mechanism is simply if you take the shorthand for this is if you have two districts that are next to each other, and one the Republican wins by 52%, and the other one the Democrat wins by, or I should say three districts. One where the Democrat wins by 52%, and the other one where he wins by 52%, or she, and the Republicans win one by 52%. They will draw the district in such a way that all the Democrats are in one, and so that one Democrat will win by 75%, and the other two districts will have a significant or slight majority Republican, but a durable majority, and that's what we have. In like you say, in Wisconsin, we have this also in Pennsylvania to some extent, and North Carolina, other states. So that's 2010. This is when you write that Holder and Obama are like, wait, what happened? They were completely blindsided. Yeah. And we should say this type of gerrymandering has gone on, goes on in 2000, in 1990, in 1980. But the difference is now is that we have the tools in 2010 that didn't exist in the past in terms of data analysis, in terms of Google Maps or whatever it was,
exactly.
That the level of efficiency in this gerrymandering changes it, not just in terms of degree, but almost in kind.
I think that's right. The kind of gerrymandering that was done in the past is gerrymandering done on maps with magic markers and people making kind of educated guesses about where they think voters live. The gerrymandering that is done in 2010 and 2011 is surgical. It is precise. It is done with the help of terabytes of voter data and the most specific precise map making software that has ever been used. And as a result, I think the media and the political science community completely missed what was going on, as did the Democratic Party, because this was an entirely different gerrymander. This was a gerrymander that would not wash away over the course of a decade as many others had over the years. This was a gerrymander that would be etched in stone and tattooed in these states.
Okay, and so Democrats get a little bit more savvy to this. I still am sort of surprised that, I mean, when you and I spoke, I think it must have been in 2016, about your book, that the Democrats had still not really ramped up a response to this. I mean, I understand that, you need to do it by 2020 because that's when the next cycle of redistricting is, but it's like I need to clean up my apartment before my parents come to visit. Well, maybe it's better to start cleaning up now instead of waiting until 15 minutes before they show up if it's a real mess, and it's certainly a real mess. But you track in your story that come the next general election, something else happens with the Republicans in 2012. What is that?
Well, 2012 comes along, and it's a pretty Democratic year, right? I mean, Obama is reelected. The Democrats hold on to the Senate, but Republicans keep the House, and they keep the House, and it's not even close. It's 234-201, even though Democrats win 1.4 million more votes. And this is the first election that is run on these new maps, and the maps provide this intense Republican firewall. And Democrats missed this. I mean, Holder, who was then Attorney General, tells me in this story that he and Obama are looking at the numbers after election night outside the Oval Office one night in December of 2012, and they can't figure out what happened. They don't understand why what they thought had been a pretty good election produced such dismal down-ballot results in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, in Michigan, in North Carolina. And it was red map. And this was when I think they finally learned what had happened 2 years earlier.
That's interesting. So the loss of the midterm elections in 2010 was people just did not pay attention to what was happening on the state level, and because they didn't understand the implications of losing these state houses in that age, and they don't realize it until December 2012 after the midterm elections. And I mean, the irony is, too, is at that time, that's when the autopsy was, wasn't it?
Yes.
Okay,
that's
remind
exactly
people
right.
What the autopsy, because yeah. I was just talking about this the other day. I just remember hearing live Sean Hannity sort of begrudgingly say something to the effect of, like, we're going to have to accept the fact that we may have to do immigration reform. And boy, that didn't work out.
Well, if you think of this, right? I mean, so in 2012, Democrats and Republicans are trying to figure out what happened in that last election. Because Democrats thought they had a pretty good night, but they couldn't figure out what had happened in the states and in the U.S. House. And Republicans had just lost the popular vote for the White House for the fifth time in the six previous presidential elections. So they were trying to figure out what their path forward was. And they do something called the autopsy. The Growth and Opportunity Project is what it's called. It's real name, but whenever you give something a nickname of the autopsy, you're not usually operating on something living. And they survey a couple of thousand Republican politicians and office holders and donors, and they do focus groups all around the country. And what they hear is that the Republican Party has become, quote, a party of stuffy old men. They talk to immigrants and immigrants who say, we don't believe the Republican Party wants us here. And they come out with a pathway forward, and they say the Republicans have got to find a message to talk to young people, to talk to communities of color, to talk to LGBTQ communities. And this really has to revolve around immigration and really creating change on immigration. The autopsy represents the path not taken for the Republican Party. And it's because of REDMAP. They had already embarked on this path of voter suppression, and the members who were elected as part of the class of 2012 to state houses around the country and also to the U.S. Congress were not the compromising kind. They were not interested in immigration reform. They were elected from completely uncompetitive districts that no longer looked like the rest of the country. What the Republicans had done in order to give themselves minority rule in the state, in these states, had also created a Frankenstein's monster in which the only thing that now mattered was the primary, and they were getting much more ideological, extreme members. They lost control of the caucus.
I mean, that also is fascinating, because we're watching through the years the Republican Party sort of play this delicate dance between their, I mean, it's a pretty, I mean, base is the Republican Party just doesn't work in the same way as the Democratic Party and vice versa, right? I mean, you have a very heterogeneous group, or I should say homogenous group of people in the Republican Party. And you've made, to the extent that they weren't, you know, like pure GOP version, it wasn't because they're a big tent as a Republican Party. It's because they had to share some space with Democrats in terms of who elects them on some level. And that would pull them, you know, slightly towards the center. They go off the rails and go to the right. And so, like, you know, like, I'm remembering the immigration fight that George Bush tried to wage, and he got rebuked by a sort of like large margin of his party, if you will. But in the end, what happens, because they redistrict these things, so it's just Republican on Republican, the margin takes over. And so, you know, we have often talked on the left of this perspective of the Republican Party, you know, the Democratic Party hates its base. The Republican Party fears its base. Well, part of the reason why the Republican Party fears its base is because of what they needed to do to win. a general election, which was basically forfeit everything to them and create these like Republican only districts. Right. I mean, that's basically what happened there.
I think it's exactly right. I mean, the 2012 election is what gives us Mark Meadows. Mark Meadows runs in the winter of 2012, when the new maps are handed down, drawn by the gerrymandered legislature in North Carolina. They crack hippie vegan Asheville down the middle. They create two Republican districts out there. Meadows runs as a birther. There's a famous video of him on the campaign trail saying he will send Barack Obama back to Kenya or wherever it is that he comes from. Meadows wins a candidate primary with about 37-38% of the vote. He doesn't even win a majority in this primary. 38% of Republicans in this gerrymandered district in North Carolina sicked Mark Meadows on our politics for the last decade. He doesn't exist if not for gerrymandering.
Okay. And so let's move ahead to 2016, but before, or I should say we shouldn't, because we need to stop off at 2013, because this is where the electoral victories are aided and abetted, and Jim Sensenbrenner's, what is it, 12,000 page more report gets essentially torched by that same guy who in 1982 wanted Ronald Reagan not to sign the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act. He really played the long game. And so 2013, the Supreme Court guts the Voting Rights Act by essentially saying that the preclearance provision is fine in theory, but you shouldn't blame. Well, you tell us, because some of this stuff is actually sort of, I think, incredibly offensive at this point. The response that folks like Scalia had to like the idea that this was a racial privilege, etc.
It's outrageous. And, you know, sometimes when we talk about Shelby County versus Holder, we talk about it the wrong way, you know, because sometimes we use it as shorthand and we don't remember the specifics of what happened there. And it's a case that revolves around Calera, Alabama, a white suburb outside of Birmingham, and a minority, a black man, is elected to the city council in Calera. The city council responds by redistricting, and they draw a new district, and in the next election, this man loses, except Calera was under preclearance. It's in Alabama. It's one of the states that had this history of incidents of racial prejudice in voting. They had to bring it to the Justice Department for preclearance. They didn't do it, and so they were forced to rerun the election under the old map. This is the example, this obvious racist example, this redistricting in order to push a black city councilor out of office and trying to do so without telling the Department of Justice. This is the example that the Chief Justice and four other conservatives on the court thought proved that racism was over,
yep.
That preclearance was no longer needed.
And I want to be clear here. That's a paraphrase, if not a direct quote, that racism is over. I mean, you had members of the court.
It's not 1965 anymore,
yeah.
Is what the Chief Justice wrote.
Yep. And
the South is a different place. This is not the South of 1965 and Jim Crow any longer. The trouble is, it was. And the very afternoon that the Shelby County decision comes down, the state of Texas institutes its brand new voter ID bill. The very weak Mississippi and Alabama come up with new voting restrictions. The idea that the South had changed was comical.
And beyond that, even beyond that, I just want to remind people that you have a conservative court that describes itself as being a non-activist court, And to the extent that one can divine what that actually means, or at least at that time it meant, was that we don't like to legislate. We defer to the legislative branch. They, Antonin Scalia said in that time, and again, this is also about like states' rights, which, of course, four of those people who voted in that, or at least a couple of them anyways, who voted in that case, voted just the other day, this week, you know, against the idea of Pennsylvania having rights to its own election. But Antonin Scalia had a piece, and, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said that it was reauthorized in 2006 or whatever it was when Sensenbrenner reauthorized it. It was reauthorized because, and 98-0, I think, in the Senate, it was reauthorized because the lawmakers were afraid of not reauthorizing it. And like, they didn't want to be labeled racist, essentially. And so this is unfair. It doesn't count, the reauthorization. I mean, it's as if like he takes complete agency away from these lawmakers to reauthorize for 25 years when, you know, it's quite clear Sensenbrenner's intent was to make sure that this didn't happen.
12,000 pages was his intent. You know, he wanted to build a record that even that conservative court could not ignore. And they did.
Yep. Okay. And so now the Voting Rights Act is gone. As you mentioned, almost all of those states, I think it was about 12, 14 of those states, have new restrictive voting laws within weeks, minutes, days, certainly within a year or two. They all have these things. They are not subject to preclearance. It's much more difficult for the Department of Justice. Not only is preclearance the issue, but it's also the burden of proof shifts in these instances. And so what happens in 2016? This is the third of the trilogy of elections.
2016, Hillary Clinton wins the popular vote by 2.8 million votes. Donald Trump takes the Electoral College by 80,000 votes in three states. And what are those three states? We keep coming back to them, right? We're talking about Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan, these three deeply gerrymandered states, all of which had enacted some sort of voter suppression methods during those previous years.
That is where the sort of the absence of any type of voter protection regimes comes into play.
The absence of any voter protection regime combined with the gerrymandering that locks these members into office regardless of public will.
So, David, that's the so now we are in. What are we? Are we in the sequel or are we in the epilogue or like what this election? I mean, we don't know yet, but what are the chances of it being, you know, another sequel like Return of the Jedi as opposed to the Empire, you know, continues to strike back or something?
Well, there's so much happening here, right? I mean, we are attempting to hold an election in the middle of a pandemic. And so all of these voting questions are front and center again. And again, what we see is that your access to the ballot box differs widely based on where you live. We see the 12-hour lines in Georgia, and we see the efforts that are being made in Texas to restrict counties to one drop box. And then you see the efforts being made in Oregon, elsewhere, you know, the vote by mail states or the automatic registration states. You have three states, again, the same three, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, where you're going to have 5 or 6 million mail-in ballots to be counted, and the legislatures of those states will not allow the nonpartisan local election officials to begin the process of opening and counting and double-checking the security and the signatures on these ballots until election day itself. So the only reason you would not allow that is if you want to throw the system into constitutional chaos, if you want to give Donald Trump the opportunity to claim victory on election night off of in-person voting and then to throw all this into the courts and give us a replay of 2000 and Bush versus Gore. You know, and all of this, of course, is playing out against a backdrop in which 2020 is another zero year. It's another redistricting and census year. The state legislatures that are elected this year are going to be the ones that draw the maps for the next decade of our politics. So there's so much going on.
And it feels like every aspect of that, like the Republicans are very good at weaponizing all of it, right? I mean, they're attacking the post office, they're attacking the census itself. So even if they end up losing these some of these states, the census information that people would redistrict on would be diminished. I mean, it does really feel like they have all cylinders operating. And we should say that the census situation would be even worse right now were it not for a guy dying who had a bad relationship with his daughter. I mean, this is nuts. I don't know if
and we were, you know, able to go through those documents. Yeah.
This is the story of Thomas Hofeller, who was
the story of Thomas Hofeller.
The Hofeller, I guess, who was the godfather of these maps. And he had come up with the idea of telling the census to put in an immigration question because he had run a model where he had found that this would dramatically help more white districts and specifically run it in Texas. And it would help the Republican Party. And he had even come up with ideas on how to have the DOJ tell the Commerce Department why they should put this immigration or this this citizenship question on the census. And not only the device, but also the alibi, essentially, he had developed for them. The Commerce Department went into the Supreme Court when they were challenged on this question and lied as to why they were adding this question. And if it wasn't for the fact that they had blatantly lied and through the work that that you did and Hofeller's daughter did, they probably would have okayed it. I mean, you know, Roberts didn't say he had a problem with what was being done. He just said, I have a problem with the way that you're presenting this case to me. I'm mad at you and you're not going to get your way. But
that's
he invited
exactly
them
right
to come back. He basically invited them to come back and they just couldn't get their act together to do it.
And they probably will come back. What is so important there is that that is the next gerrymandering plan. The next thing that Republicans want to do is redraw state legislatures based on that citizen voting age population rather than total population. Because it's not just Texas. It's Georgia. It's Missouri. It's all of these states that if you can if you only count citizens over the age of 18, you make the population – a base that you were drawing districts on older and whiter and more rural and more conservative, you lock in decades of demographic advantages. So while Democrats are out there trying to win back chambers, and that's a really important process, Republicans have got galaxy brain. They're already thinking ahead.
And is there any entity now on the Democratic side that is like, you know, contemplating this stuff and saying, here's how we're going to deal with it?
I think that there are organizations on the Democratic side thinking about this. There's certainly going to be a bloody legal battle over citizen voting age population. I think that's going to be the next front. Democrats and voting rights activists were successful in some ways in challenging the worst gerrymandered maps this decade in state courts. The trouble is it took them 8 or 9 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, the state of Pennsylvania and North Carolina were cheated out of fair representation for an entire decade. So if Republicans do this in 2021 and relief comes, you know, in 2028, it's a pyrrhic victory in many ways.
David Daley, thank you so much. The piece is fascinating, and I recommend people read your new book on Rigged and Rat-Effed to get a real sort of clear-eyed perspective on this, and hopefully there are people out there who are familiar with your work and are preparing for the next round of this battle. But thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Sam.
David Daley is the author of the national bestseller Rat Effed, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count, and the forthcoming Unrigged, How Americans Fought Back, Slayed the Gerrymander, and Reinvented Democracy. Hey, that's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. want to thank all of our free podcast subscribers who decided this week that it was time to support this program. And they did so by becoming members over at ROFpodcast.com. Very much appreciated. You are our only source of revenue, and we can't thank you enough. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch the videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show. It's called The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering the biggest news stories of the day and doing long-form, in-depth interviews with authors and journalists. Also, if you want headlines every morning, AM Quickie, amquickie.com. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.